You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the Trump administration is offering $4.7 billion in aid to farmers who are hurt by tariffs from other countries. Our guest explains why he says that amounts to a, quote, band-aid on a gunshot wound. Now, chores. The very word might send chills down the spines of children tuning in. Between dishes, raking the leaves, and straightening up their bedrooms, most kids, but not all, have a seemingly antagonistic relationship with chores. And chores might drive parents a little crazy, too, between cajoling kids to do them and then cleaning up after the chores have been done, but maybe not to the parents' standards. But chores, while frustrating in the moment, may actually make for happier kids in the long run. Our next guest is here to talk about why chores are crucial for children and their families. KJ Dell'Antonia writes about parenting for the New York Times. She's also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. KJ, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You talked a lot in your article about the parents that you talked with about chores. What did they have to say?
Most parents find chores challenging, including me, I have to say. It's really discouraging to try to persuade your kids to do the chores. It feels terrible when they don't willingly step up. When you've got a kid laying on the floor sobbing because like they won't carry their cup to the dishwasher, you feel feel like a failure. Like, geez, you know, what am I doing wrong? The parents I talked to, a lot of them, they didn't like being the bad guy around chores. And that is what it felt like.
But despite that, do parents think chores are important for kids to do?
You know, there's some research out there that suggests that most people think that chores are important, and that does include most parents, even the ones that are not actually asking their kids to do the chores. Most of us say we had chores when we were growing up, but it's a smaller number, and it's less than half of parents who say that they require their kids to do chores now.
That's interesting, because I had actually made a note of that. It seems that even parents who did do chores as children are not necessarily making that a part of raising their own kids. And I think it was 82% said that they had chores, but like you said, about half, so about 50% of those with children said they required them to do them. Why do you think that is? Did those other parents not think it was worth doing? Or is it, like you said, they don't want to be the bad guy? They want to avoid that kind of conflict with their children?
It's a lot of things. A lot of us feel like our kids are, quote unquote, too busy for chores. They have too much homework. They have too many sports. They have too many things going on. Some of us are lucky enough to have someone who helps us with the housework, so the burden doesn't feel as great necessarily. And realistically, I think we very easily fall into the trap that it is, I mean, who are we kidding? It's easier to do it yourself, especially if your kid's going to argue with you. It 100% is. It doesn't feel great. And I really think you're going to be happier if you get your kids involved in helping with the work of our shared households. But on a, like, that instant, is it easier to just go pick up the towel than go find the child who left it on the bathroom floor? Yes. Yes, it is.
In your article, you say sports and homework are not get out of chores free cards. And I actually wanted to ask you about that. Is it the kids who are using that as an excuse, or is it the parents?
I think it's both. I think parents don't put chores on the big to-do list because they have this sense of their kids as running frantic from school to sports to Kumon to music to homework, and they don't want to add to the burdens. And yeah, I mean, certainly my kids, the one getting up from the table, you know, the first one up from the table, I gotta go do my homework, and everyone else is shrieking, no, you're staying here, because yeah, we're all doing the kitchen cleanup together.
We're talking with KJ Dell'Antonia right now. She writes about parenting for the New York Times, and she recently wrote a piece that said that chores are good for kids and actually make them happier. And KJ, you talk in your article about research done by UCLA's Center on the Everyday Lives of Families. And those researchers recorded video footage of 32 middle-class dual-earner families in Los Angeles, and each of those families had at least two children. What did they find, you know, kind of peeping through the windows there?
I love that research. It's the most fascinating stuff. They found a couple of families where kids were stepping up. Most of the families, I don't remember the exact number, a significant chunk of them didn't ask kids to do anything. And then another chunk asked kids to do only sort of very, very small things like clearing their place. And often the parents would be seen stepping up to do it instead.
And also there were kids that really actively fought their parents too.
Oh, yes. Yes. Like you can find their sort of recorded description, you know, the dialogue of the child going, you know, no, I can't do that. It's too hard. And the parent trying to argue. And it's that they're very funny, the dialogues, but also sort of very telling. You can totally recognize yourself in the sort of father begging the child to tie his shoes and that sort of thing.
I have to say, it's probably a lot more entertaining to watch it than to actually be part of it.
Yeah, one of the researchers who was young at the time called it the very best birth control in the world.
Well, and I have to say, if I'm remembering correctly, it was only two, maybe, families out of the 32 where the kids just did the chores without, you know, the crying, the whining, the complaining, without the parents having to nag them. That's not a great percentage.
It's not. I think a couple of things about that. What I found in interviewing parents around chores is that parents whose kids actually, you know, were stepping up to do the chores typically were parents with a really strong, solid expectation that their kids would contribute to the running household or the running of the household. And that could be for a couple of reasons. Families of faith with a tradition of service often have a really strong sense of working together. It was a pattern that I kept seeing that they might have a less antagonistic, feeling around getting their kids to do chores. And then two income parents with maybe, you know, less household help, or even with some that had help, but where they had just really established from very, very early on an expectation and a role for kids in the running of the household.
I'm glad that you brought that up about families that have a strong faith belief. There might be some differences, because I found myself wondering that research done by the UCLA Center on the Everyday Lives of Families, they said specifically were middle class families, you know, and I wondered, do we know if there's a difference with families from different economic groups or different racial groups, or maybe urban versus rural?
I have not seen it. I have not seen actual research or data on that. So when I'm talking about, I'm just going from, basically what in some cases amounts to Facebook research, but also interviewing people. Picking out what I was looking for when I was working on the article. Well, this is really an excerpt from the book. I was looking for parents who felt happy about chores, and because I wanted to hear from them, I wanted to talk to them about, well, you know, what do you do different? Honestly, what do you do differently than me? What do you do differently than the rest of us? What is different in your household? And those were the patterns that I was seeing without my, you know, certainly that group of people was not in any way sort of demographically representative of the world, but it was interesting.
Well, let's ask our listeners to share their thoughts at 1-800-642-1234, especially, you know, how does this play out in different economic groups, maybe people of different racial backgrounds, urban versus rural? I'm guessing that kids growing up on farms, there's no question that they're going to help out with chores. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let us know what you're thinking. And let's go to the phones. And Jeff in Superior is up. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I had a question. I can't think of any other species that requires its young to contribute to chores like that. But that might be because human beings live so much longer and they keep their young with them so much longer than other species. But have they done any comparative studies about other species that require they're young to do chores.
That is really interesting. Maybe other animals just get kicked out of the den or the nest by the time they would be doing chores. KJ, is that something you've ever thought about?
I haven't thought about it with respect to animals. That is my first response is, well, they're probably, you know, the minute they're capable of getting their own food, they're probably doing it. I will say that the same researchers who did the research in Los Angeles also looked at chores in different cultures. And what they found is pretty embarrassing for a Western culture. You know, they followed children in Peru who were growing up in a more of a tribal situation. And these are, you know, they describe these children as dragging logs as thick as their legs to the fire to, you know, to contribute or doing very, it's not research that makes you feel great about the fact that, you know, you're clearing the table while your kids are looking at their phones.
We are talking to KJ Dell'Antonia right now. She writes about families and parenting for the New York Times. Her recent piece is called Happy Children Do Chores. And she's with us to talk about why chores may make for happier kids, even if it's like pulling teeth to get them to do them. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, how do you convince your kids to do chores? Maybe you don't have your kids do chores. We want to hear why. Or if you're a kid who has to do chores, what are your thoughts? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a minute here on Central Time. Right now, we pick up our conversation about the benefits of chores for children, even though they might fight their parents on it. KJ Dell'Antonia frequently writes about parenting for the New York Times, and she recently wrote about this in an article titled Happy Children Do Chores. And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. For parents, is it a struggle or is it smooth sailing when it comes to chores in your home? What kind of chores do you have your children do? Or do you opt not to have your children do chores at all? Tell us why. And kids, if you're listening, you can tell us your thoughts on chores. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And KJ, I want to talk about some of the benefits for kids of being assigned chores and parents making sure that they do them. What do kids get out of that?
Well, kids who feel like they're a necessary and contributing part of their household, their little family community, it gives them a little bit of emotional armor, if you will, against, you know, sort of feeling maybe lost and alone outside. That's a tiny piece, and there's some research that supports it. There's also some, it's a small study that suggests that kids who did chores, who started them at a very young age, are able to handle some of the pieces of adulthood, some of the responsibility of being out on their own in college and as young adults better, so that they're more successful, you know, in the parts of being being at college that involve doing things independently, so getting themselves to class or getting their work in. Again, it's a tiny study, but one of the things that I think about when I look at these little pieces of research is we don't necessarily need research to tell us that kids are going to be better off if they learn how to help out. I mean, all you have to do is sort of contemplate to yourself, which is better, the boyfriend who comes home with your daughter and gets up after dinner and says, may I help you clear the table? Or, you know, the one who kicks back and pulls his phone out of the pocket. We all know the answer to that. And nobody wants to raise the college roommate who puts their dishes in the sink and says, what, that's not all I'm supposed to do?
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Sherry in Elkhorn is up. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I wanted to mention Montessori. I retired as a secretary at a small Montessori school in Maguanago, Nature's Classroom. And I was amazed at what the kids are responsible for in each classroom. They get their morning snack together. They pick up their things and put them back on the shelf. They set up for lunch. They're responsible for taking their own place settings to the sink. After lunch, they have little chores where they'll sweep the tables off and wipe the tables. And even when they, at the end of the day, they help with the cleaning of the classroom. And kids as young as three years old have chores to do.
That's great, Sherry. And so learning chores at school, not just at home. We have quite a few callers, so I want to go right back to the phones. And Glenn in Chilton is up. Hi, Glenn.
Hello.
Hi.
The chore list that we came up with, my wife and I both work full-time, and we have four children. And it was a bit of a struggle, and eventually we're heading to Disney down the road. And we came up, my wife did, I can't take any credit for it. But it was a chore list of chores that had to be done every Saturday. And there was a cost, too, that each one paid. It was a dollar to vacuum the living room. And the kids took turns every Saturday. They would go down the list. Every chore had to be picked. And sometimes if one of the children would say, I'll do all of the chores, they could do them in maybe 3 hours if they did everything on the list.
Wow.
But they just knew that chore list had to get done, and that was their money for Disney. And it also helped when they got to Disney. My spendthrift, when she realized that all her chore money could be spent with one handful of jewelry, she said, there's no way I'm paying that kind of money for that crap, Dad.
Wow. Well, that's great, Glenn. And actually, KJ, I wanted to ask, you know, some parents do use financial incentives to get kids to do chores. Overall, is that a good approach?
Some parents absolutely do, and other people just take a different approach. You know, a common sort of rule is that if it's a normal household task, we parents don't get paid to do it, so we don't pay the kids to do it. But creating a financial incentive, I think it's fine. Star charts are fine. Setting up, you know, rewards that if you get this done 10 times in a row, we're going to do for ice cream or whatever. What I found in talking to people is that every single one of those works if you, as a parent, are making it work. That's the telling piece. Whether you're, you know, enforcing it or actually requiring at the end of every Saturday that things be done, or you're not. And if you're not, the dollars aren't going to help.
We had a caller. I love our listeners. A caller wanted to respond to our earlier call about other species, and he says that young beavers actually help maintain the dams.
Aw.
So there you go. Little beaver chores. Let's
somebody
go back.
Post a video.
That would be amazing. Let's go back to the phones, and Jeremy in Ashland is up. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. Getting my kid to do chores is an absolute nightmare. And I think the biggest thing, now we've tried the reward system, we've tried discipline. I have not tried a Ouija board yet or some other type of spiritual connection, but I think it's a huge generational shift, because I remember when I was a kid, you didn't get away with not doing your chores, because if you didn't do your chores, you were grounded, or you didn't get dinner or something, that you didn't get to go anywhere or do anything. And you just don't see that anymore. And in extreme cases, you know, there might have been physical discipline. But we don't do that to our children anymore. And we don't, there's a huge discipline gap or shift in the past 20-some odd years.
Jeremy, how old are your kids?
He is 11.
Okay, 11. So, KJ, one of the things I wanted to make sure we touched on is, you know, is it ever too late either to try different approaches to getting kids to do chores, like maybe Jeremy would appreciate hearing about, or starting. Maybe a parent hasn't expected a child to do chores, and now listening to you is thinking, maybe, you know, I should rethink this, but it's too late now. They're 11 or 13 or maybe even just 8 or 9.
Yeah. It's never too late. You can't do it any younger. The time to start is tonight, or maybe tomorrow after you've thought it through a little more. It is good for everyone, and it can be done. And that is not me saying this is easy and that this is not painful. You know, I have four kids myself, and this has been a constant. This is one of those things that we come back to, my partner and I, constantly trying to, you know, find a way to make this happen better. One of the great things that I hate to leave it alone, because the caller was so right about the culture. And if you're in a community where a lot of kids are doing chores, it will be easier to get your kid to do chores. If they're, you know, calling their friends and their friends are saying, sure, I'll come over after I've mowed the lawn, then life is easier. If you're not in that community, it's harder. You're, you know, it's tougher to get it done. But the point I wanted to make was something that I have learned that has really changed our approach is a couple of parents whose kids were sort of grown up or older and out of the house said, you need to separate. You got two things going on here. First of all, you want your child to do the chore, whatever it is. You want your child to empty the dishwasher. That dishwasher is full. You want it empty. You want the child to be the one that does it. Secondly, you'd like it if they did it cheerfully and without being reminded if it's their chore, right? Mm-hmm. Let that second piece just wave. Just let it go. It doesn't matter. All that's important is that first thing, you know, insist, persist, repeat, remind, nag, cajole, you know, make sure the kid is the one that does it and you're not, and release that feeling of failure every time you have to remind them. And believe me, I know. I mean, I know that feeling. It's just, especially when they fight back.
And KJ, I want to make sure that we get to one more caller. Nate in Plainfield is up. Hi, Nate.
Thank you. I just wanted to share a couple of things. I think the crucial element in all of this is that a parent should start by doing this these chores with their children. It doesn't work very well when you tell the child to do it and you're not doing it with them. I could see my little 2.5-year-old grandchild that he wants to do things. He wants to do things with his mother. Mm-hmm. So have him do them with them. And then as I grew up as a young child doing work with my parents, I worked with them all the way through as I grew up, and I took it as normal. This is not something I wasn't being punished. It was just normal.
And you were growing up on a farm, right, Nate?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so KJ, you know, that's a great idea, doing it alongside of a child, not instead of, you know, having them do it instead. We're going to actually have to leave it there. KJ, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. This was
KJ Dell'Antonia writes about parenting for the New York Times. Her recent piece was called Happy Kids Do Chores. She's also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent. She joined us to talk about doing chores. The Trump administration says it will hand out $4.7 billion to U.S. farmers to help offset tariffs from foreign countries. In response to President Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum, China, Mexico, Canada, the European Union, and others followed suit with tariffs on soybeans, pork, apples, and dairy products. In July, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said it would provide farmers up to $12 billion in aid. This week, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said that the $4.7 billion would soften the blow to farmers as Trump works to improve trade deals. He added that farmers, quote, cannot pay their bills with simple patriotism. Mike North is the president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be joining you.
Which agricultural products are the focus of this $4.7 billion in aid?
I think you can actually say product. The real weight was put on soybeans. And obviously, as you look at the conversation that has been looming since spring, a lot of the talk has centered on China. And most of the retaliation that we've seen from China has been, from an agricultural perspective, on soybeans. So that's exactly where the focus of this new aid package is. And when you look at how the payouts are structured, soybean farmers stand to receive $1.65 per bushel on all of their expected bushels for this year, but then they have trimmed that back and will only make a payment on 50% of that total amount, and they're reserving dollars that could then be paid if a second wave of payments is slated for another period of time down the road.
And how big a business are soybeans here in Wisconsin?
Soybeans are a growing crop in the state. They're one of our largest. functionally, they serve a great purpose in our crop rotation. They've also been a great value add for farmers. Bottom line is that, you know, Wisconsin, like many of the Midwestern states, have brought soybeans in on a 50-50 rotation with corn. So many grain farmers, where corn was planted last year, there'll be soybeans planted this year.
And are a lot of those soybeans that are planted and grown in Wisconsin then sent for export?
Most of them. We don't have much by way of processing here in the state, so a lot of the soybeans eventually work their way into the river system, find their way to the Gulf via barge, and then are loaded on ocean-going vessels and sent around the world. And if you put everything in perspective, that's true of most of the soybeans in our country. One way, shape, or form, more than 50% of the soybeans that are grown in the United States leave the United States, and China is our biggest buyer of those.
So the soybean producers are getting the lion's share of this support, but not all of it. Are there other products that are at least getting something in this package?
There is. So when you look at the numbers, by the numbers, the total that you mentioned earlier was $4.7 billion. And that's the total number that's being put forward in one piece of this aid package. And the particular piece you were referencing was the market facilitation program. The $4.7 billion is allocated among a number of different crops, seven to be precise. $3.6 billion of that goes to soybeans. Hmm. So you can see the weighting here. Three-quarters of that money is going towards soybeans. But you're seeing 6 cents a pound go to cotton. You're seeing $8 a head go to pork. You're seeing sorghum get 86 cents a bushel. Wheat get 14 cents a bushel. Dairy's getting 12 cents per hundredweight. And then corn is receiving the most laughable amount, which is 1 penny per bushel.
So, Mike, what are your overall impressions of this federal assistance?
So I think they've gone a long way to make sure that those who are growing soybeans this year are going to be helped by this $1.65 that they're proposing. Bear in mind, again, that you first are going to take the total dollars and cut them in half right away. Right. Secondly, the payment limitations that have been in place with other programs are still in force. So $125,000 per individual or entity. And then, of course, you have to not have an AGI of greater than $900,000, and you have to also comply with the highly erodible land and wetland conservation regs. But ultimately, you know, soybeans are going to see what I would call a good payment representative of what the market lost. Beyond that, though, the amounts are too scarce to really do anything with. I mean, corn, for example, corn is equal in terms of acreage around this country. Bottom line is, at a penny a bushel, the government's going to spend more money in administering the program than what farmers are going to ultimately ever get from it. A penny a bushel is it's almost a slap in the face, really, because while soybeans lost $2 in the market move lower, corn lost 80 cents. And so their move was large enough to warrant a much bigger payment than a penny. Milk is the same story, right? We saw milk prices move from $17 at their peak prior to the announcement of the tariffs, and that would be for fall months yet in the 2018 calendar. And then we watched those markets drift all the way down to levels below $15 as we were coming through the summer. Markets have rebounded since, but nonetheless, as we talk about the initial impact of the tariffs, and if this program is designed to try to offset them, then functionally 12 cents a hundredweight doesn't do very much to ultimately help farmers. Moreover, when you talk about the milk market, unlike some of these other commodities where I have the choice in whether to sell my crop today or wait for for a period of time. Dairymen don't have that luxury. Their milk goes to town every single day. It's marketed and sold every single day, and they're paid based on those sales every single day. Bottom line is they ended up having to sell at the lowest of lows. So the 12 cents really does very little. And in a state like Wisconsin, where dairy is our bread and butter, so to speak, it doesn't go very far. To put it in perspective, dairymen spend 10 cents a hundredweight on every hundredweight that they produce to go towards their marketing checkoff, which is dollars that are allocated to promote the consumption of dairy. So 12 cents, when you then take 50% of that, doesn't even cover the money they're already sending to the government in the first place.
Mike North is the president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. We're talking about the $4.7 billion aid package that the federal government is promising for farmers who are being affected by retaliatory tariffs. And, Mike, the Agriculture Department promised $12 billion in aid this summer. Where is the other $7.5 billion?
Well, so here's always the interesting thing about announcements like that. They said they were going to make available $12 billion. They did not necessarily say they were going to spend or allocate all $12 billion. So what we're seeing is roughly half of that coming out in the form of three different programs. Now, we've spent our time so far talking about the market facilitation program. So this is a direct payment to farmers, but there's also two other programs. One of them is going to be food purchases. And when you look at the breakdown, and there's a whole laundry list of different products that the government's going to buy, it accounts for another $1.239 billion. And that's split across a very diverse mix of different commodities, fruits, livestock, etc. There's lots of different things that they intend to buy. And then the third is a program that they call the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program. And this is ultimately designed to try to promote trade in other environments with new partners, with different countries. And this will go towards, you know, market research, technical assistance, you know, point of sale demonstrations. So some of this will be even spent domestically. That program allocation is about $200 million. So it's the smallest of the three. But when you put it all together, you have about $6 billion of the initial 12 that was made available. Now, keep in mind, we've mentioned that there could be another payment made at a later time. And so my speculation is that the government, if these trade conversations continue to linger, if we still can't get a deal done with Mexico, which we're, you know, hopeful that could be coming maybe as soon as this weekend, together with some talks with Canada, if we don't get anything done, they would have the capacity, I believe, to come back and allocate that next $6 billion for another program. Maybe it looks slightly different in the mix, but another round of payments that would come back for producers along these very same lines.
One quick question before we move on to those international trade negotiations. Mike, if we look at the portion of this that is buying up excess commodities, are the same producers going to benefit as the ones getting the direct aid, or will that spread the help around a little more?
So that program is much more diverse, and when you look at the list, you see things like blueberries and cranberries and apricots and grapefruits and hazelnuts and macadamia nuts and navy beans, right? So it's a much broader list than what we saw in those initial direct payments. And, you know, the reality is that trade impacts all of these environments. But when we talk about some of the initial retaliation that was made, it targeted certain commodities. So I believe when the USDA put together their list of dollars to be allocated, they kind of went top down with some of the highest targeted commodities that were being used as a retaliatory feature, and that's where the biggest payments were. And then as we saw the ripple of some of these retaliatory effects, we're going into other markets to create some offsets there as well.
We're talking about this week's announcement from the USDA that it will provide farmers with $4 billion in aid to help offset the cost of retaliatory tariffs imposed by other countries. Mike North is our guest. He's the president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer, is this federal assistance welcome news, or is it not nearly enough? How badly have you been hurt by tariffs from China, Mexico, Canada, the EU, and elsewhere? Are you hopeful this will all lead to better trade deals in the end? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're continuing our discussion on the $4.7 billion aid package from the USDA to go to farmers affected by retaliatory tariffs. Mike North is the president and founder of Commodity Risk Management Group in Platteville. And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this federal assistance? If you're a farmer, what else do you need? And are you willing to tolerate short-term pain for the potential of better trade deals? How hopeful are you about the proposed new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Stan in Hales Corners is up. Hi, Stan.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I want to know why me as a taxpayer is supposed to, this $12 billion, $4.5 billion is coming from somewhere. It's coming from me and other people like me. Why am I not supposed to pay that to the farmers? I know the farmers are hurting, but when I look at the polls at the end of in 2016 and after the election, the farmers voted for the Trump administration to get in office. Why aren't they taking the suffering just like for who they voted for? This is the policy they voted for.
Thanks for that call, Stan. And Mike, what would your response be?
I guess my response would be fairly simple. The reality is that the tariff conversation revolves around an effort that's looking at trade more broadly, and the goal being to create opportunities across the board for all industries. And when China came back, and we saw this of Mexico too, and to a lesser extent from Canada, they came back with a retaliatory package that was aimed, I would say, very strategically at the agriculture industry, because as the caller pointed out, there were a lot of farmers that did vote for Trump, and I would go so far as to say that rural America was really what pushed Trump's win over the edge. So they came right at his supporters and hit him where it hurt. So when you look at the list of items that China pushed back on, they did it from a very political standpoint, with the goal of endangering and harming a particular industry.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jerry in Ripon is up. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. My question is, I have beans stored from the 2017 harvest. I had them for sale at $10.01 a bushel at Ripon, and they never hit that target. What do I do in this compensation plan, being that they're last year's beans stored for sale and typically sell in June or July?
And these are soybeans, right, Jerry?
Yes, soybeans.
All right. Mike, what would you say to Jerry? What options does he have?
Well, the reality is there's another crop coming. And so the soybeans that you're carrying are something that probably aren't going to gain a whole lot of added value. We've told our clients to be aggressive with making sales against 17. Frankly, we've been out of them for a while. But in your particular case, carrying them is going to be a very, very tough proposition. So in light of the fact that you are going to get, what really adds up to about 82.5 cents, once you look at the 50% factor, I'd be looking at that as your offset to unload the soybeans and get rid of them. because frankly, when you look at the softer price, some of that has to do with tariff right now, but a lot of that right now simply is a function of big inventories of soybeans, and looking out forward, there's going to be a lot of continued pressure in our market.
Let's go back to the phones, and Ted in Johnstown is up. Hi, Ted.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My biggest concern about this whole thing is all this money that Trump's going to do, or whoever's going to do, is going to go to the big corporate farms. Small family farms aren't going to get it.
And we're running a little short on time. I want to make sure that Mike can respond. So, Mike, Ted is saying he thinks it's going to go to the big farms that maybe have a little more to get them through these times, and the small farms are going to really struggle. Do you feel like the system where it's set up on a per bushel or per head basis, is that making it a fairer equation?
Actually, it's working just the opposite. By putting in the $125,000 cap on a per unit basis, the larger farms stand to receive less than the smaller farms. So frankly, on a bushel by bushel basis, everyone gets the same, but when you hit that 125, you're out. You're done. So the bigger you are, the less you stand to gain.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ted. In a phone call Monday with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, President Trump announced a preliminary trade deal with Mexico that calls for zero tariffs on dairy and agricultural products. He predicted it would be a big winner for the U.S. Let's take a listen.
Our farmers are going to be so happy. You know, my farmers, the farmers have stuck with me. I said we were going to do this. And Mexico's promised to immediately start purchasing as much farm product as they can. They're going to work on that very hard.
Mike, how optimistic are you about the potential there?
I think the Mexican deal looks very solid, and the fact that they are considering some concessions on geographical indicators for us, and the fact that Mexico has been a longstanding partner of ours on a trade, agricultural trade basis, this is very, very good news for all of agriculture. You know, I think beyond that, though, since the automotive trade is the biggest piece, it's what Mexico and U.S. trade back and forth the most. The fact that they're calling for increases in wages for Mexican workers also, I believe, stands to help the agriculture industry, largely because as people have more available dollars in their pocket, it's a trend that's been observed across the world. The first thing they do is improve their diet, and protein is the first thing they seek out. So whether you're talking pork or you're talking dairy proteins by the way of powder or cheese or whey or what have you, there's room for added growth there. And with Mexico being our largest trade partner on the ag side and our fastest growing partner on the ag side, that really is making all of agriculture smile right now.
And also, of course, Canada, a very big trade partner, and for Wisconsin especially, and the Trump administration is hoping that Canada will make its decision about staying within this new NAFTA by tomorrow because of some other pressures. So we will certainly be watching that. Mike, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us up to speed.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mike North is the president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. We talked with him about the $4.7 billion in federal aid for farmers who've been hurt by retaliatory tariffs from other countries. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, bone marrow transplants have been used to treat leukemia and other deadly diseases for 50 years now. We'll find out about the deep Wisconsin roots of that life-saving procedure. And we'll look at news that the federal watchdog in charge of student loans has resigned, saying that he couldn't do the job he was supposed to protect students from predatory lenders. That and more tomorrow on Central Time.